Hi, I'm Algie Hall, an associate editor here at the Investors Chronicle, and you're about to hear my conversation with Michael Mauboussin. Michael is a highly respected Wall Street strategist, the author of several books, and a professor of finance at Columbia University. My discussion with Michael is about a recent paper he wrote in reaction to research into the sources of mistakes that people make when forecasting. Michael has written widely on the kinds of techniques that investors can employ to avoid making mistakes, and this is what our conversation chiefly focused on. Many of Michael's ideas are included in our cover feature this week, a 7-step guide to getting a behavioral edge. It was a real privilege to speak to Michael, and it's a privilege to share the conversation with you. Right. Well, it's a real pleasure to talk to you, actually. And also, I kind of feel like I should begin just by saying thank you, because I've been introduced to so many really great ideas by reading your work. So I am a fan. I'll try to make this not too fancy.
I'm so happy to hear that. Thank you.
I kind of wanted to start by just asking you something, which was kind of the from the conclusions of the piece, which I was just really interested when I read that the training techniques designed to reduce bias, you say, appear to be effective in dealing with noise as well. And it just tallied with something I was thinking when I was reading the article, which is that whilst there's this very interesting separation of noise and bias errors, whether the behaviours which lead to both types of error are quite often intertwined.
You know, first of all, I should just underscore that finding came from the research done by Tetlock and Bellers and all those folks. So that wasn't me. That was just me reporting on what they found. And I personally found this whole line of research fascinating, right? And revelatory. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, have been following as closely as I can the work by Kahneman and Cass Sunstein and Siboney on noise. So I was familiar with that, but I hadn't seen this deconstruction. So yeah, I guess it's an interesting point about this training. And we, you know, as they point out, there are different forms of training, some that does, you know, just telling people about biases tends not to, certainly not unpleasant, but doesn't help anybody get better. But it's interesting that I guess the point here that we don't really know, or this is some insight as to the cause and effect of this, what this training actually does. And I guess to me the main theme is just getting people to be more systematic in how they think about solving problems or making predictions. So yeah, I guess it makes sense once you learn about these techniques that it would perhaps serve both reducing noise and reducing bias. But it's not, I guess and as you think about it, it makes some sense that it would reduce noise as well.
Okay, and also you just touched on that the idea that You can teach people about biases which exist, but it doesn't really do very much. But so the teaching has to be about checking for ways of checking your own biases. And I was just wondering, you know, why you think there's such a great distinction there.
Yeah, because I think that without having specific tools to allow people to improve the quality of their judgments, it doesn't seem to stick for whatever reason. And, you know, I've always found it interesting, and I certainly would have the same experience that, you know, Kahneman has said many times that notwithstanding that he uncovered many of these biases, that he still finds himself subject to them all the time. So obviously he's much more aware, and I'm assuming he's coping with them. But the fact is, they don't go away. They're just sort of you know, it's like a visual perception problem, right? Like what are they called? Illusion, optical. It's like an optical illusion. So an optical illusion. You know that what you're seeing is not what you're seeing, but your mind can't. It keeps telling you that it is. You know that you're seeing the wrong thing. And I'll just mention, you know, I alluded to these briefly, but, you know, techniques such as using base rates or pre-mortems or red team, blue team, or journaling your decisions in such a way that allow you to give yourself intermediate feedback as your decision, as the facts around your decision unfold, I think they're not expensive techniques. They're not complicated. They require some discipline, but those are all very straightforward things that people can do to help get better.
Well, yeah, no, I really wanted to get a bit more into that. I mean, one of the things which I was reading, actually following the notes on your piece to another earlier Tetlock paper, was that there's some evidence that even just asking yourself the same question twice can produce a far more effective response.
And that plays right into noise, right? Because that's the whole point of noise, is that you know, you and I answer the same question twice, that we're not going to be completely consistent. And how do we reduce noise? Is, you know, of course we could average our own guesses, but if you add your average, if you're unsystematic in your decision or in your responses, then averaging against yourself actually will get you more closer to the answer. So it's kind of a neat little technique. Yeah, so that makes sense. If that is noise, and noise is truly non-systematic, that would actually make complete sense.
Also, you mentioned base rates, and I kind of feel you could be described as a person who wrote the book on base rates, seeing as yes. You did write a book on base rate at exactly. Credit Suisse. but I was really interested in just in terms of how good that is at improving decision making in terms of the research. But also you make the comment that base rates are woefully underutilized. Yeah. And I was just wondering what you think the barriers are to people actually adopting base rates.
Let me first answer that question, then perhaps, you know, the limitations. Mm-hmm. I think that there are two barriers primarily. One is that when you've proceeded with the inside view, right? So you've actually studied something, you've gathered information, and perhaps you have an experience with it or an intuition about how something works. You feel like you've done your job, right? You feel like you've sort of completed the task. And you tend to place a lot of weight. We all tend to place a lot of weight on our own information and our own sense of how things should be. So that's the first, is just we're biased to believe that what we've done is sufficient to solve the problem. And then the second one, which is not trivial, is that base rates are often not at your fingertips. You know, you move from one city to another. It's a very new, it's a unique experience for you, right? It's your first time, but many people have probably made very similar types of journeys, and you just don't know about that and what their experiences have been. So we just don't think about or know of or appeal to the base rates, even if they're out there. And that's one of the reasons we really want to spend time putting together corporate performance data, not so much because it would be shocking to anybody, just because I personally had a thirst to understand those things and just had never seen it before, like quite literally had never seen it. So the first time I saw a lot of those data were when we actually put it together, which was quite interesting. Now, you made a comment, like I say, that, you know, it's woefully underutilized. I think where these kinds of ideas work the most effectively is where we have pretty well-behaved distributions of outcomes. So things like, you know, revenue growth rates, you know, they're not perfectly mm-hmm. normally distributed. And of course, there's always going to be the extreme company, you know, because the distribution is going to shift over time. But for the most part, there's going to be a lot of value in applying that and thinking about businesses using that lens, or margins or return on capital patterns and those kinds of things. Where the distributions are heavily skewed, or even power laws, where they're really the notion of a mean, an average really is a nonsensical average, a concept, that's going to get much more difficult. And so, you know, that is some things in our day-to-day life. Things that are awfully socially driven, book sales, music sales, film sales. There is some predictability with sequels and stuff like that, but for the most part, we don't really know exactly how they're gonna perform, and it's a power law. You know, many things do very poorly, and a few things are just huge blockbusters. So the nature of that outcome is very different. So that's where, I mean, knowing about the distribution, of course, is very, very helpful in and of itself. And certainly, if you talk to a music producer or an editor, as you know, for books, they all know that this is the case. But that's a great, I mean, it's a great line of inquiry. And so my point is that when I say that it's underutilized, there are lots of domains where we have a lot of good statistics mm-hmm. That can be gathered with, perhaps in some cases with some effort, but can be gathered, and people just don't pay much attention to them. And that's why, I mean, the base rate book that you referred to, that corporate, you know, that's data that's, you know, people should be using and thinking about.
Yeah. And I mean, also, I mean, do you think people have a tendency to think the situations they're looking at are a bit more special than they are? So, especially after forming that inside view.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the psychology of all this, right? Which is we tend to think our own experiences are more unique than they are in reality. You know, Dan Gilbert wrote this great book called Stumbling Upon Happiness, which you might know, a dozen years ago or something. But he talks a lot about this idea that we have a sense of uniqueness, but in fact, often our thinking is benefited by recognizing our commonalities, right? So we are unique, obviously, in some ways. But the commonalities are often more useful to think about. So yeah, I think that's right. And again, it goes back to the same thing. Like I've asked you to do research on something, and you know you've done it, and you research a company, and you've read about it, and you built a model, and you talk to the company. So, you know, you've put in effort, and you believe that your initiative itself is of value, and you obviously place value on your own sense of what's going on, versus again relying or deferring to something that feels like it's a little bit, you know, I think Kahneman used the term pallid for statistical reasoning. You know, it just doesn't resonate with you, whereas it's much more intimate and persuasive to rely on your own work.
Now, as a writer, I know all about the power of narrative. I was wondering actually also in terms of the inside view or just bias in general. From reading your paper, I was left thinking about the kind of ability of that to amplify noise, as it were. And I suppose, so this is kind of coming back slightly to the first question I ask. If I'm, for instance, bullish on something, and then my overconfidence takes over, and my forecast is therefore wildly optimistic, in the reverse being true when I'm bearish. I mean, do you see this lack of control of those biases is maybe amplifying all the results we see from
I mean, I think that it's an interesting, because again, now we have to also make another distinction between, you know, you and I could be wildly bearish or bullish, maybe even on the same thing, but we in reality we have to deal with prices, right, with markets.
Yes.
And so there's another component, which is the market itself represents the collective wisdom or madness of the crowd, right? So
yes.
It probably vacillates between those two states. And so you might think that everything's way wildly overvalued, but it's hard for your voice to be heard. You can sell whatever, go sell short or whatever, or you could think things are wildly undervalued and buy as much as you can, but there's a limit to what we can do. I'm reading a very interesting book called Perfectly Confident by Don Moore. This book just came out the last couple of weeks, and it's about and Don's done a lot of work on overconfidence as a general concept. And you know, there may be some virtues in overconfidence in the sense that, you know, this optimism isn't in some ways motivating. But I think he makes a very sensible case and by the way, also being underconfident. You know, so for example, if you're a student and you're about to take an exam, you know, the sense I'm going to fail may motivate you to work harder to prepare, for instance, right, to lead to a better outcome. So there can be virtues of both of these things. But his argument is ultimately, you know, the ideal is to be well calibrated, and it's very difficult to be well calibrated unless you really keep track and give yourself feedback and so forth. So, I don't know, but like, so there, you know, one of the optimism or overconfidence is considered to be a bias. That is, I think that's true. And Don actually wrote a couple papers to be very careful about how it manifests in the real world. I think that I wrote about it briefly, but the one I think is most relevant for investors is the concept of over-precision, is that we tend to think we understand how the future will unfold better than we actually do. And so the scenarios we paint are not imaginative enough or varied enough to capture the reality.
So if I can just ask you, I was very keen to ask you about your comment on mediating assessment protocols, because I've got a bit of a vested interest here. And in my email, I think I kind of slightly explained it, that we've been we run share tips in our magazine, and we have a system, a very simple system, just in terms of breaking down the decision making process. And I mean, as I understand it, that's what mediating assessment protocols are. They're kind of unpackaging decisions.
Yeah.
And your comment in the piece was that they're more useful in guiding organizational decisions than investment choices, mm-hmm. which slightly broke my heart in some way.
It shouldn't, though. And first of all, I applaud you. I think it's great, and I'm in the front row, wishing you continued success with that. I guess my reservation would be. And that's why I did it as a mental experiment in the paper as well, which is to say something like, you know, what would the world look like if markets were perfectly efficient? You know, we have this bin model. Would any of this be relevant? And the answer would be no, right? Because noise doesn't matter, bias doesn't matter, information is reflected in asset prices, and so we just go about our merry way. And so everyone earns what they're supposed to earn and so forth. Now, we know that's not true, but it's not as far from the truth as – you know, everything is sort of completely chaotic and random and so forth, right? So, So that to me is and markets have different degrees of efficiency and so on and so forth. But the reason I like so much what you're doing is that I do think that that disaggregating and so by the way, it's interesting that the application where I've used the protocols historically has been actually in interviewing. And I think that's the example mm-hmm. actually given the piece, but that I have found to be the most, I think most interviewing is done very poorly. That's been well documented. It's, you know, you and I sit down and have a coffee and just chat about the world has proven very non-predictive of success for a job. And I do think and this is what Kahneman talked about. He did in the Israeli army many years ago, just developing some protocols to understand what skills we're trying to identify and to be systematic and having different people do it independently, systematic assess those skills. So to the degree to which you can really specify what you believe are the ingredients of a good investment, for instance, and you feel confident that if these criteria are met, you're going to be good. This is certainly not a bad way to go at it, right? Because you're ensuring that you're being systematic and you're ensuring you're being thorough. And if you have multiple people, for example, perhaps evaluating on those criteria that you select, and independently come to similar conclusions or the same conclusion, that probably raises your confidence that you've got something interesting. So, yeah. So when I said that, I was mostly thinking about market efficiency. And, you know, we just know empirically it's very difficult for people to do much. It's not, of course, people do better in the market, but it's just empirically. We know that it's not a trivial task.
Absolutely. Well, no, it's good to know that it's not necessarily a completely useless venture.
It's definitely not. And I'll say that as you saw that I also alluded to this a number of times, which is and we wrote another piece on this where I talked about in a little bit more depth, but it's a very interesting thing as an investor if you say and you know this is probably more sophisticated someone who does this for a living, but if you really say let's evaluate sort of the whole process from where an idea comes into our awareness to how we assess it to how we build it and put it into the portfolio and how we construct a portfolio. You know, as you think about that whole process, the question really is what of those tasks can be achieved, you know, call it algorithmically or systematically, and then where does judgment come into play? And if you're a discretionary investor, I think there's no question that there's going to be judgment, right? It's just a question of where that judgment applies and where it doesn't really apply. And I think the example I gave was, you know, position sizing, you know, you know, and I think the position sizing can be something that ends up being sort of somewhat of a mathematical calculation, provided you use your judgments to inform these various, you know, inputs, objectives and constraints and so forth. So it's an interesting, and I do think because my sense is still the systematic investors and discretionary investors are two different tribes that have a very difficult time communicating with one another. Yes. And if we were to try to find common ground, this may be one step. You know, the systematic people recognizing the judgment is important in some cases, and then certainly the discretionary people recognizing that some tasks that they're trying to take on could be done better systematically. And that, of course, would be very valuable in reducing or at least partially reducing noise, right? If I'm very consistent when I get an input, I have the same output. That algorithm, that means I've reduced or minimized or noise, which is good. Yeah.
I was very interested in. I thought it's fascinating what you were saying about position sizing, and also Some of the research about there was buying fast, selling fast, buying slow, I think.
I'm skeptical about that myself, but yeah.
Oh, really?
I wrote about it, but I'm skeptical. I mean, here's why I'm skeptical. I'll just say that, and I'm friends with the people that produce this stuff. There were two things in there, and one of them I was more persuaded of than the other. The first was that, this idea that I buy well and I create alpha and then I sell too late or whatever. But, you know, for every buyer, there's a seller, right? And in the aggregate markets, complete markets, alpha nets to zero right before fees. Mm-hmm. So in some way it has to be zero sum. So that's sort of an open question. There can't be just sort of one person gaining that all, you know. So again, you know, your positive alpha is my negative alpha in this it's a zero sum by definition, right? Because alpha is a y-intercept of a regression. Yeah. And it has to be a zero. Okay. So that's the first thing. So now if you open up the world and say, well, it's not a closed system, it's not a zero sum, and there are other parties that interact with investors, including corporations and so forth, the waters get muddied in that case, but I just don't know that it's that tidy. Now, the second one where I actually felt I feel more comfortable with is that there's a consulting firm where the guy would go sit down with a portfolio manager, the fund manager, and say, tell me how you want to size positions. And then the fund manager sort of, you know, in a quiet moment, hopefully a thoughtful moment, like spells out how he or she wants to size positions or how they do it, mm-hmm. at least conceptually. And then this consultant guy writes it down. And what he found, or what he claims that he found, was when he reviewed how those managers actually sized positions, that they deviated quite a bit from what they said they wanted to do or what they said they did. Right. So his point was, gee, if you just did what you said you laid out, you would actually be more effective. And it was something, it was not insignificant. It was like 75 basis points a year or 100 basis points a year or something like that of performance. It's in the piece, I think. So,
yeah.
So that's, you know, all of us, you know, it's just like anything. It's like, you say, oh, I'm going to go on this diet or I'm going to go on this workout regimen. It's, you know, it's very well specified, but the key is really the execution, not saying what it is. The diet regime can sound wonderful, but unless you actually execute it, it doesn't do much.
I was looking up actually in your note just before we spoke, because I thought there'd been you'd mentioned that people don't follow through, or professionals don't follow through their best ideas with conviction in their portfolio. Did you reference that in the notes?
I may have referenced that. There are some papers on that topic. Yeah. I may have alluded to that. I'm not sure I totally know what I believe about that. But by the way, it's not an easy thing, right? Because in investing, when you're a long only in particular, mm-hmm. you have expected values for particular securities, and if you buy something, it goes up, right? All things being equal, and I'm not saying they are, but all things being equal, your expected returns go down, right? So you should be a smaller position, and vice versa, right? The stock goes down, all things being equal, the expected returns go up. Now, obviously, things are not always equal, so it's a more dynamic situation that. But that means that the things that are bigger, things you want to be small, and you know, so it's a tricky thing. But I think that there has been a fair bit of research that shows that. Most managers add very little value from sizing, and most of the value they add is through position size, is through security selection. So mm-hmm. The question, I guess the open question is, might there be ways to more efficiently capture that skill in security selection, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have lots of I have friends who work for these multi-strategy firms, right? So they're literally looking at dozens and dozens of portfolios and systematically analyzing the actions of the fund managers. And I think they would say 1 in 10 of their managers they see actually add value from sizing. Almost none of them do.
Right, right. That's very interesting. So I wanted another thing that I wanted to ask you about just from the paper was the issue of the frequency of updating beliefs. And I mean, it just seems like this is obviously an amazing skill to have, but it also seems to be an incredibly rare skill to have, and one which people find it very hard to acquire. I was just wondering what you how you viewed it.
I think it's a really interesting one, and in many of these decision making sort of qualities, I always do wonder how much of it's just people's personalities versus, you know, sort of like the way they are, nature, if you will, versus what they're trained to do. And clearly, and I think we, you know, I allude to it, I think that the work by Tetlock and others suggest that many of these are skills that can be cultivated. But yeah, it's this idea of being open-minded and being as attuned to new information and being able to assess it, and then to revise your priors, not only in the right direction, which hopefully we can get bluntly right, but also in the right magnitude. And I do think it's interesting that the super forecasters tended to adjust their probabilities both more frequently than the regular forecasters, and also with more granularity than regular forecasters. So both more often and with finer resolution, which is really interesting, right? So and you would think, you know, is this sort of a false thing, but apparently it's actually adds some value. So, you know, how do you get people to do that? I don't know, but I think that's a really interesting quality. And part of it is that, you know, this goes back to confirmation bias, which I think we also allude to in the piece, is that, you know, the truth is that most of us are cognitively lazy. And once you've sort of made up your mind about something or have a belief about something, the path of least resistance is to keep believing what you believe, right? In fact, when confronted with evidence that your belief is false or only partially true, I mean, most of us would just prefer not to. It's cognitively taxing to try to change your mind. And so I think these super forecasters, or this quality we all want to emulate, is not a cognitively challenging thing to do, because you're not constantly changing your mind, but you're constantly revising your views. So you can't be wedded too strongly to any particular thing. And Tetlock's got this line in the book, in Super Forecasting, which I love. And he says, you know, beliefs, what is it? Not treasure to be printed. Beliefs are something like, you know, I'm spacing on the line, but it's something like beliefs are not treasures to be protected. They're things you need to update all the time. So anyway, yeah. So I don't know. I know, you know, how you do that, but one of the things I will say, and you know, having written about the super forecasting stuff a fair bit and this idea of keeping track, is that, and this is one of Kahneman's big things, is just documentation of your decision process can be very helpful. And even maybe even the things you're doing. I mean, I know you're doing the media assessment protocol, which is really great, and that is giving you, you know, some sort of rigorous sense of how you approach something. But even saying, you know, here's what we expect the market's going to miss. Here's the way that's going to manifest, and here's the probability that will occur. And as it occurs or doesn't occur, you're going to have these, you're going to get intermediate feedback that allows you to update your views. And just, I think the other lesson about all this stuff on probabilistic thinking is the more we practice, the better we get at it. So it's like anything. And so just creating the apparatus and then actually doing it and practicing getting feedback will make people better.
I mean, you talk about in the paper the fact that people, are better with probabilities when it's expressed in numbers rather than words. And especially as a writer, I kind of wonder whether that's, you know, it's depersonalizing what's actually being said.
Right. By the way, the quote is, beliefs should be hypotheses that should be tested, not treasures to be protected. That's it. So beliefs are hypotheses to be tested, not treasures to be protected. You know, it's funny. I don't know if you saw. I referenced it, but it was actually a very fun professional thing for me. So we did a little write up in the Harvard Business Review. I did with my oldest son about words to probabilities. And I don't know if you saw that. So I'll just tell you about it. And as a writer, you'll find this quite interesting. So we selected 23 words or phrases that are common to think about, you know, probabilities or possible and so forth. And then we put them on a website, probabilitysurvey.com, and then people who come to it are served those words or phrases in random order, so there's no bias in just how people see them. And then you're asked to look at a word and then attach a probability to it, a numerical probability. And then we report back on, and we've had thousands of people do this, we report back on what people say, what probabilities they associate with various words. And, you know, as you might expect, certain words or phrases evoke very narrow probabilities. So most people kind of converge to the same answer. But other phrases or words have huge ranges of interpretation. So a phrase like, it's a real possibility, the 5th and 95th percentiles are like 20% and 80%. Right. So if you say something, you write an article and say, this is a real possibility, you should acknowledge that your audience, you know, some of your audience is going to hear 1 in 5 and some of your audience is going to hear 3 in 4. Right. And it's a very different, very, very different thing. So that's why this numerical probability thing. Now, sometimes it sounds overly precise, but there even are techniques to allow you to translate your beliefs into numerical probabilities or bets in ways that are more concrete. So yeah, it's so as a writer, you know, and by the way, I try to do a little bit of writing too, and I'm with you on this. I think it's really important that we're storytellers, right? And so it is, if you're trying to be an effective communicator, you have to be a storyteller. The question is whether you could envelop, you know, your statistical reasoning in the story in some way that makes it, you know, you basically put a little less sugar around the pill and let people eat it that way. So the stories of the sugar that allow it to go down.
There's always ways of trying to creep around what you're actually saying that may provide you escape route.
I'll just mention something else. It's funny that sometimes I'll read even books or journals, articles or so forth, and I'll read it and I'll believe it, I understand it, and I'll keep going. And then I'll go to write something where I really need to understand it, and I'll go back and then I'll reread it, and then it'll become clear to me that the author didn't really understand what he or she was talking about, right? And so they use words or phrases to be able to sort of get something out there, but without really, you know. So it's a funny thing how that works, right? Because there's a sort of a superficial level, but people who are really good get the deeper level. So it's a topic for another day.
Well, yeah, it's something for every writer to aspire to be the person who explains things simply.
I'll tell you this, like Matt Levine at Bloomberg, have you read his column? You know that guy?
Yes, I do. I don't read him come totally regularly, but yeah, I do know him.
God, that guy I think is unbelievable, and he's funny, and he's, you know, I find him great. And then the other one is, and I'm not sure he gets everything right either, but is Michael Lewis, which is just the guy's, it's like embarrassing how good that guy is. And I don't know, it just comes off, makes it look easy, but I know it can't be that easy.
I wanted to ask you also just about the comments on the weighting of information. Kind of later on when you're talking about information, the weighting of information is kind of all back to front in the way people naturally come at it. I think you said when the strength of information is high and the weight is low, people become overconfident, right. Which is exactly when there's, you know, just a tiny bit of evidence, but yeah, very weak.
That's right.
I was just kind of structures that can be put in place in terms of the techniques that you talk about, which
I think that's a really tricky one. Because you know, the question is the reason I struggle is because many of the answers to these kinds of questions, or the discussion we should have about these kinds of questions, is very domain specific, you know. So in some areas that it's all very easy to do, you know. So I give these examples of coin flipping, which is you can conceive of no simpler system than that, right? So the point becomes quite vivid, but in the real world it becomes much more nuanced. I wrote a HBR article, and it was called "What Makes for a Useful Statistic," and it gets to a little bit to this. And by the way, these are ideas that are well understood in the statistical world, right? So I said for something to be useful, there have to be two elements. One is that it's persistent, and persistent means that it correlates with itself over time, and that often means you do need sample size to make it grounded. So I guess the main point there is just sample size is really important. And then the second component is that it's predictive of the outcome you're trying to achieve. And that's also, there are statistics that are very persistent but not predictive of anything, and others that are very predictive but not persistent. So people do have to give a lot of thought to that you and I could have the same 10 bits of information, but how we order them and weight them can be very materially different. It actually ties back to the portfolio construction point. And I'll just mention that a exercise I do with my students every year, which I always find interesting, is I hand them a sheet with 25 companies on it, stocks. And what we're working off is the actual 2013 year. So I'm assuming people don't remember what happened to the stock market 7 or 8 years ago. And so I say, pick no fewer than five, and of course up to 25 of these securities. So you build your little mini portfolio and then weight them as you see fit. So you can, you know, if you want to have 25 and each is a 4% weight, or you want to have five and they're each 20% weight, whatever you want, right? So anything with those parameters in place. And then after they've built their little portfolios, I hand them the second sheet with the actual returns of the stocks, right? Now, I constructed in such a way that if you bought all 25 and equal weighted them, you would earn the S&P 500 return, like on the button, right? So that's sort of the benchmark. And we get ranges from students losing 10% to people making 100%, right? So my point is you have the same raw material, right, in quotation marks, right, which is the same 25 stocks and the same instructions from me. Sorry. So everybody's got the same basic raw materials. And with those same raw materials, we get very, very different outcomes, right? Conclusions. So that's a little bit like the information weighting thing. The other thing I'll say on that is I wrote a chapter about it in one of my books, and I always, the story I told about this was I think it's true. I don't think it's apocryphal, which is Bill Gates apparently in the 1990s used to walk around with a list of priorities for Microsoft. And, you know, so whatever he was thinking about that was important about the future of the company. And a couple of his engineers went to a conference at Cornell University. This is like 92, 93, something like that, where they learned about the Internet and what was happening with the Internet. And they came back to Seattle and they said, Bill, like this Internet thing is going to be huge. And he's like, no, it's on my list. It's number five. And they said, no, you don't understand. Like it should be number one and then a huge gap and then everything else. And apparently, you know, that's when sort of Gates saw the light and reshifted it, you know, re-emphasized the company's orientation more toward the Internet. But that's a good example where he had it. It wasn't new information to him. It just wasn't weighted sufficiently. So I think it's a tricky thing. And even going back to your map, right, like you think about, okay, so I have my factors that I think will contribute to success in my investment idea or in my hiring process or whatever it is. But even those, are they all equally weighted, or should some things be? Do we know that some things tend to be more important than others?
You've mentioned the map, and it brings me back to the idea of algorithms, which you also talk about, and when algorithms can be used and when they can't. Because I think I mentioned to you, the map that I've done, it's the Israeli army test, and and so we're almost interviewing job candidates for interesting stocks. Yeah. Do you have good momentum? Do you have value? Things like that.
That's right.
But just in terms of how applicable algorithms are and when they should and shouldn't be used, you make a distinction about that in the paper as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it really is ends up being it's a cause and effect, right? When you can map out cause and effect, I think that tends to be where algorithms should be used. I think the general finding, going back to Paul Meehl, which I wrote about briefly, is that algorithms tend to be very effective and underutilized because we rely on our judgment. I was visiting with someone who just graduated from medical school and is going into becoming an emergency room doctor, and he was saying, I said, how are you guys trained? And he's like, it's basically algorithms now. You know, you come in and we're taught these algorithms, and, you know, obviously we have to incorporate our judgment from time to time, but basically the default is the algorithm. So this is actually not being taught in medicine, which is also quite interesting. The other thing I found really fascinating, and there are a couple papers I allude to in their reference, but is the work by Cade Massey and some of his colleagues on algorithm aversion. And the idea is that, first of all, that many of us become very averse to using algorithms, especially if the algorithm spits out the wrong answer, right? Mm-hmm. Now, if a human spits out the wrong answer, the human will say, "Oh, I'm sorry, I was overweight. I was overweight. The airlines, my fault. I'm sorry. I didn't see this thing happening, but I've readjusted my portfolio, and now we're good to go. We're ready to right." And so there's almost like a narrative again that can be explained. So ex post explanations, whereas the algorithm, of course, has, can say nothing. So. The technique that and I love this, you know, Kahneman called it the first time I met with Kahneman, he laid out this concept and I wrote it down. It's always stuck with me, is this idea of disciplined intuition, which is, and you mentioned the Israeli army thing, which is use the algorithm first, see where that gets you, and then introduce your judgment at the very end versus starting with your judgment and then using the algorithm, because you're going to be skewed by your prior views. I love that as a discipline, and I do, because by the way, there are many things in life, and in fact many things related to markets and business, where human judgment is actually still very valuable. I think it's going to be a long time before we can use anything approaching, for example, machine learning to understand what's going to happen. I think machine learning and those techniques, even statistical techniques, are very valuable for shorter term horizons, so quick trading and so forth. But if you say, what will the world look like in 3 years or 5 years or 10 years or 15 years, there's simply no, because there's no, you can't train anything because there's nothing to train it on. So human judgment. Now, whether humans are better than, how good humans are at this is another question, but certainly judgment can be very valuable in that regard.
Yeah, no, I always think that the disciplined intuition, the kind of final bit of the algorithm which was added in, and it being the judgment of the assessor, and it actually turning out more valuable. It's kind of slightly Pandora box-esque. Like, it's hope from the bottom of the box.
It is.
Just in terms of feedback, and you've talked a lot about kind of writing things down and journals and everything. I mean, obviously with investing, feedback's so hard because there's so much luck involved, as well as skill. And obviously you've written extensively about disentangling the two and how tricky it is. Is the kind of journal keeping and writing down the decision, how the decision was made, is that a real key to getting feedback?
I think it is. And so I think, you know, I take your point, which is exactly right, which is it's very difficult to get feedback because let's say in the short to intermediate term, the feedback is very noisy, let's say, right? Because prices themselves incorporate lots of things that are maybe unrelated. So, but the point being that if you have a thesis to buy something or sell something, what you're saying is that you believe something about the world that is not priced into the security, right? So you have to have some sense of what that is. And that should be something you can A, articulate, and then B, write it down. And I think I may have alluded to it in the piece, but just to be more concrete. And again, this is, I tip my hat. This is all Phil Tetlock. I'm getting this from him. But this idea of the Breyer score, right? And so for you to have a Breyer score, you need three things. One is an outcome that we can agree upon. So if it occurs, you know, we sold 110 widgets or we did not, right? So we're going to agree on that. Second is a specified date, so by a particular time. So nothing's open-ended. And then third is it's got to be important to your thesis, right? So you have this thesis. If you have those three criteria, then you're in business, right? And what you're going to do is make forecasts and you're going to attach probabilities to your non-consensus view occurring. Right. And so what you can do, and that's why we call it, you essentially can have these signposts, and you say, if my thesis unfolds as I anticipate, we will pass these signs that are saying that we're on the right track, that revenues will be higher, or profits will be higher, or whatever it is you're going to do. And those will be time elements, right? So quarter, half year, and so forth. And then all of a sudden, you're giving yourself lots of intermediate feedback on the process of your decision making that we should have some faith will lead to the ultimate outcome of superior performance, right? So it's breaking down the problem. And it's very much like MAP, right? You're breaking down the problem into its components. The other thing that's nice about these signposts is if your thesis rests on, you know, they're going to split up the company or spin off division X by a certain date, and that does not happen, that then gives you a pause point for, let's going back to our thing on updating your probabilities, is for you to update your views, right? And by the way, it gives you not only an occasion to do that, it compels you to do it, right? Because, right. And so I think there are a lot of nice things that go with it. Now, what it doesn't allow you to do is make up stories to explain away why you got things wrong. That Barb Mellor's quote at the beginning, I love, which is, we're bad at prediction and great at explaining why the past, and so you want to get away from that as much as possible. And I refer to this paper in the very back, and it's a sort of weird paper from 30 or 40 years ago about weather forecasters, but I've always loved it, because what they did is they kept track of their weather forecasts probabilistically, and then they gave them that immediate feedback. And they did that year one, and then year two, what they found was they became markedly more calibrated. They became better at it. And so there you should have some belief and some faith that if you do this for yourself and you're helping, you're giving yourself honest feedback, that's objective feedback, that you'll just get better at it. And so I found, by the way, just step one is asking people to attach probabilities to events. Most people just don't think about it. So that act in and of itself becomes helpful. And then if you attach this mechanism to keep track and give people feedback. So it's, again, these are not widely used techniques at all, but they're very simple. And where they have been used, they prove to be very effective.
I mean, also, I suppose what, in fact, thinking about it, what strikes me is that to an extent, they're quite scary, because putting your views on the line to be
scrutinized,
to be ridiculed potentially, or to get into trouble for being wrong.
Right. And that's what Ted Locke is. I mean, there are some exceptions, but for the most part, Ted Locke has invited, leading pundits to subject their forecasts to scorekeeping. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, they've declined to do that, right? Because if you're in the pundit business, that's not really, coming across as inaccurate is not a great thing. And those guys are just storytellers, right, to some degree. But it depends what your objective is. So if your objective is to be a pundit and to get people to read you and, have a consulting business or whatever, that may be very different than your objective being improving the quality of your actual assessments, right? And I would imagine if you're in the intelligence community, for example, and, accuracy is really important, that these kinds of techniques would be important. And I think the investment world, most parts of the business world, I think these things are important. It may not be important in the pundit world, the consulting world and stuff like that. So, yeah, I think for the most part, we should acknowledge that these are skills worth cultivating with outcomes that can really be beneficial.
Yeah, I really love, there was a line in the conclusion of this paper, which I kind of felt was so succinct and possibly captured absolutely everything you could, which is just that improving consistency can add a great deal of value. And right. But I was wondering, am I being too simplistic?
I'll go off on another little tangent. But Atul Gawande, who's a wonderful doctor and a beautiful writer himself and so forth. He did a podcast and he talked about, and I guess he was very interested in philosophy, and he talked about a paper that was written in the 1970s, and it was about medicine. And he said, how do we get better at medicine? And he said, basically, there are two domains. Domain number one is identifying new things, right? So new drugs, new therapies, new ways to do surgery, what have you. And so that's very sexy and very, this novelty is very, Okay. He said, and then the second way to improve is to just do what we know how to do better or more consistently. So, this, and he obviously wrote this book called The Checklist Manifesto, which was based on Peter Pronovost's work at Johns Hopkins. And Pronovost's comment was, the doctors know exactly what they're supposed to do. They just don't do it. And if we just got them to do what they know they're supposed to do, i.e. consistency, we get much better outcomes. And I would just say that, I think it's probably a little bit hyperbolic, but probably not too much, that Peter Pronovost has saved probably hundreds of thousands of lives and hundreds of millions of dollars for hospitals by encouraging them to adopt checklists in a rigorous and systematic fashion. So just by being consistent, much better outcomes. So there's a really good concrete example of that idea working. So that is, and I think that's really what, that's noise reduction, right? Classic noise reduction. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that, I don't think it is simplistic at all. I think that's exactly right. And it's just, and that's why I thought that alpha theory thing about, you know, the sitting down with the fund manager and saying, how do you want to size positions? And they lay it out all very beautifully. And then they go off and do something totally different from what they say, right?
Yeah.
It's not that they don't know how to do it. It's just like the doctor's not washing his or her hands, or they're not doing whatever they're supposed to do in the procedure. And it's not for lack of knowledge, it's for a lack of execution. So I think that's actually simple but correct.
I mean, I was also thinking in terms of that comment. I mean, to get good feedback, if you're acting consistency, your feedback's going to be a huge amount better. Because there aren't the silly little things which you forgot to do, which will muddy the waters.
I think that's right. I agree.
I had one question. I was wondering if there's anything that you do in terms of your own life and your own investments to control your own bias. Were there any techniques that you put in place?
Well, I have to say that, and now, because I spend a fair bit of time, so I almost always think about these things almost now in second nature. The the one that if you ask me for the most powerful thing, and what I wish I could go back and teach myself of 30 years ago, you know, is the idea of base rates. I think base rates are, once you understand the basic concept and understand how to apply it. And by the way, in the base rate book, you may have seen this, but it, you know, it's 150 pages, but really the first 10 or 15 pages, and there are a lot of pictures, so it's actually not that many words, is actually really valuable, because not only it explains a little bit of how you think about integrating the inside versus the outside view, because it's not all one or the other. And it also has a beneficial sort of side discussion on regression toward the mean. And investors, you know, whenever you say regression toward the mean to an investor, especially a value investor, they'll nod quite vigorously. But very few people know how to systematically think about the rate at which regression toward the mean occurs. And this actually gives you some insights into how that works as well. So to me, base rates is a great example. So if people say things to me, the first thing that will go off in my head is how does that fit with what we know about the base rate of performance for that kind of thing. So that definitely works. I do also, I could be better at it, but I do also tend to reasonably systematic seek alternative views. So, and whether it's political or something about a company or a thesis about an industry or what have you. So I'm perfectly happy to read about the Bitcoin bull who thinks it's going to take over the world and the person who thinks it's complete malarkey. So this idea of just exposing yourself, and literally on the television, I'll watch different channels from different parts of the political spectrum just to hear what people are saying on all sides. So I think that this idea of being open-minded mm-hmm. about things and recognizing that if you're trying to get out of that echo chamber, so that'd be another little technique. But and then I try to I'm not as good as that I could, but I do try to read well outside of the discipline, right? So I read a fair bit of stuff that's not investment related. So it's just to make sure that I'm trying to get myself exposed to different ideas. I'm sure I could do better. I got to say that that's the thing is, like, you know, having been around this and having taught this and so forth, it does help. I mean, I know now, you know, we wrote a piece called Literally Methods to Improve Decisions. And, those are things I actually believe in, and it's second nature might be strong, but in other words, it's the first set of tools I reach for when I try to think properly.
Right. I think implementing knowledge oneself is actually far harder than acquiring it and expressing it to others. I think sometimes so.
Agreed.
Yeah. Great. Such a pleasure to talk to you. I feel much wiser.
Yeah. As a result. No, thank you. No, you're very kind, and thank you for spending so much time and preparing so many great discussion points. It's good stuff. And so
brilliant. Thank you very much. Okay. Bye.